Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and today we're talking about Product Hunt. A little over 5 years ago, Ryan posted a tweet. It read, quote, "Just announced a new experiment, Product Hunt," end quote. It got 36 retweets, but that link to an email newsletter prototype turned into a full product, a full startup. And a few years later, it sold to AngelList for a rumored $20 million.
My name is Ryan Hoover. I'm the founder of Product Hunt. Also do some investing out of a fund called Weekend Fund. And I do a lot of things, but mostly just working on Product Hunt is my day-to-day.
But the thing is, Ryan isn't an engineer. He knows a bit of code, but he's more of a product guy. In fact, he spent years researching, writing about, and developing products, and then created Product Hunt, the place where you can discover products. He shares how he built Product Hunt, what he's learned about product management, and what he looks for in products and founders that he invests in. After this. So you are probably best known, at least maybe to our community, for Product Hunt, which is the place to discover your next favorite thing. And the rumors are that it was sold to AngelList for about $20 million in 2016. I don't know if you're able to confirm or not, but that's the rumors anyway. And so in building a company that was so successful that it got acquired and is such a darling, people freaking love this thing. They love Product Hunt. How were you able to do something that feels very technical without being super technical yourself?
So I've always dabbled with technology. Back when I was a kid, I built websites for fun, hacked my Xbox for fun. And I think video games is probably my gateway into a lot of the world of technology and IRC and all these other things. And so I've always dabbled with technology and built things. Oftentimes, though, when I built them, like the first website I built was actually largely powered by like Dreamweaver.
Mm-hmm.
And so
yeah.
For me, I've always enjoyed making things. Mm-hmm. And actually, this goes even beyond, I think, code and products and websites. But I also used to film and like create a lot of videos. So mm-hmm. when I was, you know, dabbling with things, it was a lot of it was just hacking things together and figuring out, like, how do I use the resources and skills I have to create something that maybe it's an MVP or just kind of a kernel of an idea. But that was usually kind of how I started.
Mm-hmm. So when you were growing up and you were building all these things, both technical things and like videos and more creative other stuff, did you ever hit a wall where you said, man, if only I really knew how to code, I could do these things. And because I don't have that skill, I'm stuck.
You know, I taught myself HTML and some basics of how to get a website up when I was in high school. And I quickly realized in myself that I took some classes in college, minor in computer information technology, and I actually took some CS classes as well in addition to that. And I actually found it just not fun, not as enjoyable once I got to a certain place. And certainly with anything that you learn, you hit this sort of wall and you have to like really power through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't have enough motivation to power through it. I didn't see myself as someone who would sit at a computer and code, like as a primary function of my role.
Mm-hmm.
I much more enjoyed the aspects of design and product design and marketing and later on more community building.
Yeah.
But certainly I wish I could code. Like I wish I could do a lot of things, but you have to ultimately prioritize and like focus on the things you want to do and the things that you are good at, I think.
I really appreciate that because being, you know, the founder of Code Newbie, you might assume that I think everyone should code, and I don't. I think that if you want to code, then you should do it. And we're here to support you and encourage you and make sure you cross the finish line if that's what you want. But if you try it, and it sounds like between your computer science classes and the minor in computer information technology and all that, it sounds like you gave it a very honest effort and you're like, that's not for me. And that's totally cool.
Yeah. Again, it takes a lot of different skills and talents to build a great product and a great business. And so I feel like in the past decade, we've had a lot of focus on engineering is sort of the, that's the thing that you do if you want to get into technology. You know, not everyone needs to be an engineer. Not everyone should be an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And if everyone was an engineer, then we actually wouldn't build great businesses if it was purely focused entirely on that.
That is a good point. So you describe yourself as being a product guy. What does that mean?
Yeah, I don't even know if I like that term anymore because it's so vague. But what I mean by that is I really, and this is why Product Hunt started really, is I just love playing with products and exploring them. And I love the creativity of building a product. And I used to, prior to Product Hunt, really, I would browse the app store in Japan and just see what was popular and what people were playing with. And I just found it fascinating and interesting to see how they were different than maybe some of the products I was familiar with.
I'm curious, what differences did you see in the Japanese app market compared to the US?
Yeah, so some of it, and this was back in probably 2010, 2011 is when I was really kind of exploring. It was around the time I moved to San Francisco. It felt more complex, actually, but a lot of it felt a little bit more colorful, more complex in terms of the number of features and things. You know, if you look today, there's actually a really good video by Connie Chan from Andreessen Horowitz that she published recently that goes into some of the differences between the business models of the East and the West and how, you know, companies like Tencent have, you know, they basically build the modern day AOL homepage in some ways within a mobile app with, you know, transactions. And if you look at WeChat as one example, it has built an app store essentially along with peer-to-peer payments and so many other things, unlike many other Western apps, which really usually focus on one kind of singular use case.
That's true. Yeah. Huh. So I want to talk about what happened before Product Hunt and how you ended up building and creating Product Hunt. Let's go back to that minor in computer information technology. After you graduated, what did you do? What was the plan?
So it was actually my senior year in college. I grew up in Eugene, Oregon, went to school there at the University of Oregon. And the senior year in college, I actually found out there was an internship opportunity at a video game company. It was an unpaid internship. And so I applied, I got it. And that internship after I graduated turned into a full-time role, which then I moved to Portland, Oregon. And so I learned a lot about marketing. I quickly moved on to product management while at that company. And then ended up segueing into, moved to San Francisco in 2010 to join another company in the gaming industry.
Yeah. So marketing to product development feels like a big jump. How did you make that transition?
It's one of the hardest roles to get a job in part because there are just so few product managers relative to engineers or even designers and other functions in most companies. And so there's a lot less supply, I guess, of jobs. And the other challenge is that most companies won't hire someone unless they have product management experience before. So then it has another challenge of like, well, how do I get in? For me, it was very organic and I was fortunate in that I was doing marketing initially, but I reported to the VP of product and we collaborated a bunch and we would jam on different product ideas. And I was, you know, at the time we were focusing a lot on Facebook's API and building our platform on top of Facebook. And so I would constantly be digging into Facebook's API changes and actually try to observe like, what are they doing and how could we leverage or change their direction based on some of the new capabilities that they're offering. And so there's a lot of these conversations with Tony that led eventually to him bringing me on as a product manager because they were looking for someone in the role.
So at that point, did you have side projects you were working on or a personal portfolio where you were doing some product stuff? Or was it mostly that interest in that research?
At that time, I was not doing any side projects. I was focused pretty much 100% on work. But, you know, I was constantly like tinkering and exploring ways that, you know, I could take these weekend learnings and apply them to things we were building or working on in the company.
I think the other thing that makes the product manager position a little tough is you need to have product management experience, but you also need to have management experience, right? Because you're managing a product, but usually that also means kind of managing engineers and other coders and kind of bringing the team together towards a specific goal. And that's tough. It's tough to get that management experience. How did you manage that?
Well, kind of a couple different ways of putting it. I would say it's ironically product management, even though it has the word management in the title, I never managed anyone directly.
Oh, nice.
Like I had no direct reports. And I've seen this pretty common in product management roles, unless you're like VP level or something like that. A lot of times the product manager is an individual contributor and they have no authority in some ways. And so they have to earn it. And it becomes a role that requires just clarity of thinking and communication. And since you're sort of interacting with pretty much everyone in the company from sales team to engineers, designers, to customers, external customers. You just have to be really good at communicating. And mm-hmm. I think that's one of the most important aspects of that role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I think the last thing that you did before Product Hunt is Playhaven. Is that the company that we're talking about?
So the company that I first joined was called Instant Action. And then I joined Playhaven in 2010 and moved to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. And how was Playhaven? What were you up to there?
Yeah, so that was also a product management role. And so I followed one of the execs that actually worked at Instant Action. And he was joining this new company called Playhaven, about 10, 12 people at the time when I joined. And we were focused on supporting mobile game developers, like building tools for them. And that was a really awesome experience, learned a ton. The scariest part, though, was shortly in the beginning. When I joined, moved all the way from Oregon to San Francisco, the company was in, it wasn't in a bad spot, but we were at a place where the product that they built when we joined wasn't a product that would scale to be a venture backable business. And so it was sort of at these crossroads where the company and the team needed to figure out, we can't just go down this direction forever. We need to figure it out. We need to change directions entirely and essentially pivot. And there were some layoffs, and I ended up surviving some of those layoffs. And we ended up, me and Andy, the CEO, and the rest of the team really got together and thought about, like, what does the market need and what are we observing? What are we learning? We ended up, long story short, building out these tools that we realized that a lot of game developers were basically reinventing the wheel. They were creating ways for them to message their users in-game, to do cross-promotion between their various titles. Basically, all these things people were building in-house themselves. And so instead, we said, well, why don't we allow these game developers to focus on building the game, and we'll focus on building the tools so you don't have to do all the other stuff. We did well, you know, grew from 10 people down to 6 to like 100 or so before I left.
And, wow. that's a comeback. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a good experience. Now, today it's the company. We'll see where they go. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's the ups and downs of startups. I guess I experienced that pretty quickly once I moved to San Francisco.
Coming up next, Ryan shares his biggest takeaways over the years of doing Product Hunt. He also tells us what he looks for in the products and people he invests in, and how you can get started in product management after this. Tales from the Command Line. It gives us a chance to dig into one particular part of the episode and hear a different perspective from a really experienced developer in the field, Scott McCarty.
Yeah, my name is Scott McCarty. I am a principal product manager, and I focus on containers, like all the technology within containers that enables Red Hat Enterprise Linux and OpenShift.
Let's begin. So, product development, do you remember the first product you ever managed?
Technically, I'm actually in the first product I've ever managed.
Okay.
I was at a startup before I came to Red Hat, and I actually was like, you know, an engineer that helped develop some of the products and then maintain some of the products, but I wasn't the product manager. There wasn't even really a product manager per se. We were like a 7-person company. But technically, my first product management role is the product, because there's kind of multiple pieces and parts of products that I'm managing right now.
Huh. What are the products, plural, that you're managing? What are they?
So I manage containers, like the container technology for Red Hat Enterprise Linux and the underpinnings of OpenShift. So like my role basically bridges a few pieces of technology that are in both Red Hat Enterprise Linux and OpenShift.
That seems like a lot of stuff.
They're very technical products.
Yeah. Very intense. And so this was, did you kind of level up to eventually have all these under your belt, or just right away you were just doing all this stuff?
There's a particular framework for approaching product management called pragmatic marketing. And they use a system where they describe 37 different functions that you basically need to meet to get a product out the door.
Okay.
In a very small company, a product manager would do all 37. As the product, obviously, it gets bigger and sells more and has more sophisticated features, you break up those 37 boxes into different roles. Product management and product marketing are probably the two big roles. But then you also have sometimes competitive product people that will go analyze competitive products. A lot of times there will be architects that live, you know, in the engineering group, but they will do some of the 37 boxes. A lot of the times you may have public relations teams that handle explaining what's going on. I was an engineer. Then I moved into technical sales. then moved into technical marketing. Mm-hmm. And so like I was already doing a lot of those 37 boxes and then I moved into product management. And so now I'm kind of really doing a lot of those 37 boxes.
So in your current role managing all these products, I assume it involves a lot of meetings, maybe a bunch of Trello boards. Like what does that actually look like?
I joke probably more than 50% of my work is unplanned.
Surprise tasks?
Yeah, surprise tasks. You know, your day as a product manager can consist of talking to legal about 3 different legal issues, talking to engineering about 42 different things that could go wrong that are going to prevent the product from releasing, talking to QE, who's saying that they can't test the stuff that engineering's building because engineering's doing it wrong, talking to support because support's annoyed because QE won't test that thing. And so they're like, well, we're not going to support unless QE tests it. It involves talking to consultants who are mad because they're trying to deploy the stuff on site and it's not supported because QE wouldn't test something because engineering didn't build it in the right way. Then you could talk to sales because they're complaining because they want some new feature that can't be built because you're going and fighting the other fire.
Yeah.
Like there's just all these different functions that interface with you.
And remind me again, what does QE stand for?
Quality engineering.
Quality engineering.
Quality engineering. Okay. So they're the people that build all the tests to make sure the stuff that engineers build actually works right.
That sounds important. So it sounds like when you are thinking about product development and you're managing all these pieces, it sounds like there are a lot of things that could go wrong. I'm wondering, what is the worst product development related experience that you've had?
Large product launches are much, much harder. So when I was at a startup, it was actually quite easy. A specific customer that you were helping would come to you and say, hey, it'd be really cool if you built XYZ for us. We'd be like, that sounds like a good idea. Let's do that. Maybe we can sell that to some other people. Big revenue streams have lots of customers that are very sophisticated. And so when you're providing a very differentiated product to a large group of people, which is typically what happens when you're making a lot of money, the requirements are just so much more sophisticated. And so then customer XYZ will come to you and say, hey, you should build this cool feature for us. And we're like, whoa, wait a minute. That sounds like that feature could be cool, but it would require changes to all this other stuff and affect all these other customers. I don't know if that's the best idea. You're always min-maxing. You're always looking, okay, yeah, there could be some incremental revenue we'd gain here, but we might lose revenue over there. And you got to start to analyze. And that's the hardest part for a product manager, right? Like I'm putting out all these fires day in and day out. But at the same time, I'm looking to the future of our product and how we're going to continue to grow the revenue and keep making money, keep producing differentiated features that customers want to pay for.
Yeah.
So that's probably the hardest piece of my job right now.
One thing I'm appreciating is that you didn't say the most technically challenging products are tough. You said the ones that generate a lot of revenue. And I'm really appreciating the fact that the fires you put out are not always technical fires. They're money fires and business fires.
Yeah. Money fires, legal fires. Yeah, all kinds of fires.
All kinds of things. Yeah. So when you think about your job balancing the, I don't know what to call it, like a purely tech side of things versus the bigger picture of the company and the finances and the revenue and the clients, what percentage of your time, of your abilities is spent in each world?
You know, it depends on what kind of change you're trying to make to the product. Sometimes there's legal changes. Sometimes there's pricing packaging changes, like how you're going to sell the product. Obviously, there's always technical stuff. You're always adding new features. The biggest problem is talking to customers, figuring out what they need, figuring out what's realistic, and then backlogging work so that we can get new stuff out the door. Sometimes competitive stuff is harder. Like a competitor just came out with a new product that is released at a different price point than yours. And you're like, oh my gosh, we got to come out with a competitive thing, like a subversion of ours that's got a smaller feature set that competes at that price point. PMs in a nutshell have to build buyer partner. They have to decide, you know, build buyer partner. That's the highest level thing that they have to decide, or at least try to influence the organization to do.
You mentioned earlier that it's not always the big company, it's the size of the product, which may or may not be related to the company. But is there something about working at a huge company that complicates the product development, product management journey?
I don't know if it's cause and effect in that way. I think that it's correlation for sure, which means that you have to be worried about it as a problem. Say you're an engineer right now, say you're a senior engineer, or maybe even an architect, and you're like, you know, I think I want to get into product management. I would say at a bigger company, it's still harder. That's for sure. But I don't think that's causal because the company's bigger. I think it correlates with the company's bigger because it has better products that are more complicated that generate more revenue.
Mm.
And so in that scenario, yes, the requirements for a PM are just harder. To be really successful as a PM and drive a really important product within a big organization mm-hmm. is probably one of the harder jobs there are.
Mm-hmm. So if someone listening is interested in getting into product development and getting into product management and kind of heading off the team and doing a lot of stuff that you're doing now, it's fascinating because you've taken such an interesting path to get here. You've done so many different things to get to where you are today. But if you were giving advice to someone who would like to end up where you are, what would that advice be?
I would say the same advice that was given me, just be really good at what you're doing right now.
Mm.
Like if you're an architect, you know, help the PM, help them deal with legal, help them deal with finance and all these things. Like there's going to be technical challenges to every one of these legal or finance or competitive challenges that there are, feature requests and things. There is the opportunity for all of these different roles to like kind of move into the other ones. But I have to admit, you have to be really good at what you're doing and be a really good expert at what you are.
Mm.
And then there will be a natural point where you're like, okay, I'm pretty good at this.
Do you feel like you needed all the stuff that came before it in order to do the job you're doing now well?
Yes. So like I follow a guy named Steven Snofsky. He he's become like an angel investor and but he was at Microsoft early on. And like his argument is that you should spend about 3 to 4 years in any given role. It should not be a year or 2 years, because in a year or 2 years, you've only barely seen like one product release.
Mm.
You need to see about 2 big product releases to really be an expert at your role.
Huh.
You might release the first product and you learn a lot during that first launch. But then when you launch the second one, you go, oh yeah, here's all the things we screwed up in the first one. Let's fix this, and this. The second one, you rock it. And then you're like, all right, now I've outgrown these britches. Now it's time for the next thing.
Mm.
Like enjoy the journey, because you got a long career. We're all going to be working longer than we probably want to. So enjoy the process.
And now back to the interview. So when you were at Playhaven, I believe is when the idea for Product Hunt came to be. Is that right?
So it was about 3 years into working at Playhaven. I started to get the itch, and there were two kind of themes. One, I felt like I wasn't learning as quickly as I did in the early days. Company was more mature. There was more more process, just more people, and there was also some challenges with what we're building, like a lot of technical debt and some other things. And then two, I really wanted to build something for myself, something that I was a consumer of. Those two realizations, I thought maybe it's time for me to move on and find something new. And so I gave notice and didn't know what I was going to do next, actually. It was sort of in between that moment that the idea for Product Hunt came up, and I started to work on that on the side.
Yeah. And so why Product Hunt? Was it the main thing? Was it the idea that initially grabbed your attention, or where did that particular idea come from?
I'd been tinkering with some other ideas and kind of experimenting with like landing pages and just playing around with different concepts. But Product Hunt was the one that really stood out to me, because me and my friends are, you know, at the time and still today, we share what products we're using, what apps we're discovering.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of a combination of, one, we're sharing and talking about these products, but then where do you do that online?
Mm-hmm.
Like, where is there a destination to really geek out about these products and talk about, intellectually kind of talk about what we think about the onboarding flow? Like we were nerds in that sense. Like we like to go deep on some of these things. And I really thought that there was a hole in the market to host a conversation like that and bring people together that also had similar passions around technology.
Yeah. So I'm really fascinated by how you validated this, because when we think about lean startup and MVP and all that, there's so many different ways to actually implement it. You know, is it just a landing page? And if you get, you know, X number of subscribers or people who hit it, then it's validated. Is it the number of people who actually contribute to a fully developed platform? You know, at what point do you say, okay, I have something here? So besides your personal interest and your close friends validating it and saying, you know, we do this anyway, might as well have an online place to do it, how are you able to validate that this was bigger than you?
Prior to all of that, I maybe the year prior to Product Hunt started, I started writing a lot and blogging and writing a lot about technology. And I really enjoyed using writing as a vehicle to learn. By doing that a bunch, I wrote 150 articles in 2013. Wow. And some of those are really short, wow. but, you know, it was actually a lot. That's every morning I was writing. And by doing that, being really active on Twitter, it started building, you know, a small but big enough audience where at least when I tweeted or put something out there, there were some people that would notice. Mm. When Product Hunt started, I had the idea, went to Phil's, and a couple weeks prior, actually saw this product that was built by this team out of Europe, and it was called LinkyDink. And I saw this product and I thought, oh, this is really creative. It's a way to host collaborative email digests where you could invite a friend or group of friends, and basically they would just post a link, and then every day at 5 p.m., the system would actually just email everyone that subscribed to that list these mm-hmm. links. And mm-hmm. so it was pretty broad, open use case. And I thought, well, I love products and I love discovering products and sharing them with friends. What if I create an email list? I'll name it Product Hunt because it's about products and it's sort of like hunting for products. Mm-hmm. And what if every day we just shared together through this email list products that we thought were cool and interesting? Mm-hmm. And so that's how it started, which took about 20, 30 minutes to actually build that email list.
Oh, wow.
Tweet it out and write about it.
That's awesome. That's very minimum.
Yeah, it was very minimum. And a lot of people assume they hear about the email kind of first approach of Product Hunt, and they think that I was curating and I was writing this email every day. But actually, it wasn't even me. I was in some ways curating, I guess, the people, but the people were curating from day one the products and everything. So Product Hunt has always been community driven. It's always been collaborative, even in its like, tiny email kind of MVP.
So when you put that email prototype out into the world, what were you expecting? Did you have your own personal goals of, you know, if I hit 100 subscribers, then I'm good. I got it. You know what I mean? Did you have like milestones for yourself at that point?
I did not. The way I thought about it and the way I've always thought about, I guess, side projects is I actually didn't even call it a project. It's called an experiment in the very beginning. The whole purpose of an experiment is to learn. It's not to necessarily win or to get to a finish line necessarily, but it's actually to learn whether it's working or it's not or other things like that. And so a lot of it was just being very experimental and open-minded and learning how people were using it. You know, it was after, I don't know how many subscribers we got up to, but several hundred, not anything crazy, but several hundred. And then a bunch of people also like kind of coming up to me and saying they enjoyed the email. That was sort of some validation that there was something there. It was like something, there's a kernel of an idea that could grow into something much bigger.
Mm. At what point did you say, okay, experiment is over. Now we need to take the next step, whatever that step is.
Yeah, it went from experiment, and then it was around Thanksgiving, actually, 2013 Thanksgiving. I emailed my buddy, Nathan Bashaw, and I emailed him initially asking, hey, Nathan, I have this email list. It's called Product Hunt. It's starting to work. But obviously, I want to build a website that people can comment on, that's more interactive, that can build community. And I asked him, what would you recommend I use to build this? Like, should I learn Ruby on Rails? Should I use like Telescope, which at the time was like an open source framework to like build sort of a kind of like Reddit style communities? And Nathan's a really unique person that he's a designer. He's a product person. He's also an engineer. So he's a great guy. And we worked on it then kind of remotely as he was back at home. We were jamming on different product ideas and specs. And as he was sort of focusing on then executing on like building the actual product, which was just a simple way to post a link, have comments and upvote. That was basically it. Mm-hmm. I was then also working a lot on collaboratively working on the product, but also then seeding the community and getting people excited. And so getting beta testers in, getting their feedback, emailing people that were kind of signing up, like a lot of really manual community building efforts to get things off the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. And that brings me back to the beginning of this conversation when you were saying that there's so much more than code and so much more than being a great engineer required to make a product work and definitely to make a business work. And it sounds like you were doing a lot of the other stuff, the community building, the marketing, the branding, the engagement. Even when you think about, you know, setting up a beta, that takes organization, logistics, you got to track stuff. You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes into it that's outside of a code base.
Yeah. And we've seen a lot of Product Hunt for X, so Product Hunt for different categories of things. And we've also seen direct ripoffs. In fact, pretty early in the first year or so, we had like a Korean version of Product Hunt, Japanese version of Product Hunt, and a bunch of others. And there was even kind of like an open source Product Hunt. And none of them took off. None of them sustained. And it's largely because – the process of building Product Hunt, the technology is not what is defensible and, mm-hmm, and what's mm-hmm. most compelling. It's really the community and the people in it and the brand.
How did it feel to watch all the ripoffs? Did you take it as a compliment or were you pissed off?
I wasn't pissed off. It was more, it was validation for sure. Mm-hmm. Especially when people started describing their product as Product Hunt for health foods, mm-hmm, Product mm-hmm. Hunt for YouTube videos, Product Hunt for music, all of that.
Yeah.
You've seen that with like Uber for X, Airbnb mm-hmm, for mm-hmm. X. So yeah. It was definitely validating. And while I think it's wise to be cautious of competitors, potential competitors, it's also like the old saying is like, it's probably not the competitors that are going to kill you. It's mm-hmm, usually mm-hmm, yourself in most cases.
Yeah. When you were building out, especially that first year or two, when you were building out the features and moving it from this email thing where I assume the features were already built for you, right? You're just using it and moving into building a platform yourself. How did you decide what to build? Did you rely heavily on customer interviews, on your gut, your years of product development know-how, or where did those ideas come from?
One, always have a vision of what you want to build, sort of what's your North Star? Like, what's the purpose of this thing? Mm-hmm. But then with that, a lot of the inspiration for what we've built has been just looking at how people use the product and how they, especially if they're trying to use it in unexpected ways. I think that's a really good source of ideas and also source of validation that if you build this thing, people will use it. Mm-hmm. And so every now and then we would share mock-ups actually of what we're building and use Envision to just annotate and show or rather give people an opportunity to annotate on the mock-ups themselves. Like, a lot of times people would say, I don't get this, or this doesn't make sense, or mm-hmm. hey, what if you did XYZ? People felt involved and like really part of the process, and they were. And that was a great way to, even if we did listen to them, but even if we didn't listen to any of their ideas, the reality is by demonstrating and involving them in the process and giving them a preview of what we were building, mm-hmm. that built community and built kind of the brand that we have today.
Yeah. When you mentioned the North Star, it reminded me that there are different levels, I guess, of a product. You know, the North Star probably being the top level, the high, this is the general direction, this is where we're all headed towards. And then there's the, okay, to do that, we need to help people do these types of jobs or these types of tasks. Okay, now we're going to go even further in and say, okay, but the way you do these tasks is through these three button clicks, and the buttons will be orange, right? So there's kind of mm-hmm. different layers of feedback for people. At what point did you incorporate users in or user feedback in deciding which of those layers to change or to modify? And which of those did you decide to do based on what you thought was best?
Yeah, there's always the balance and struggle with, you know, the things that users ask for. They ask for all kinds of things. And mm-hmm. they may not have the full picture of what you're building. And so I guess that's one thing to always take into consideration is the biggest and most strategic moves are really difficult for a user to actually tell you because they don't have the full picture of what you're kind of building. And so a lot of it's trying to understand why are they asking for this particular feature, because sometimes the solution that they're coming up with is not necessarily the right solution, but the underlying problem or need that they're trying to solve is. And so maybe an example of this is we noticed early on that people were creating their own lists of products. Mm-hmm. So they were using other tools like Trello or other like just list collection tools to write down and copy and paste links on Product Hunt to different tools. And they'd, they'd name them free startup tools or design tools I love or whatnot. Yeah. And so we noticed this happening and we thought, well, we see this behavior. Why don't we make it easy for them to create these lists themselves on Product Hunt in just a single click or a couple clicks? And that has been successful in kind of building for behavior. And now people create all kinds of collections. And it's used for not only storage of like remembering and bookmarking these things, but then it also allows us to segue that feature into a way to curate products.
Yeah, that makes sense. Was there ever a thing that you saw people do that you said, nah, that's not what we're doing here. That's not what we're building. That's not where you want to go.
I think one of the most common requests has always been around personalization. And people often say, hey, why don't you make the product and homepage entirely personalized and all these other things. And I think personalization is this common trap actually within social products and consumer products in general.
Yeah.
Is that either one, it will go against what you're building, and I'll describe kind of why I think it doesn't work for Product Hunt. But two, it oftentimes will have a very marginal impact unless you're a massive scale. the desire for personalization is a common one. And the reason why I don't think it's right for product hunt, I mean, we do have aspects of personalization, but the reason why I don't think we should change our homepage entirely to a personalized feed is that the whole purpose and where people get value out of product hunt is the water cooler effect and having this front page where people can say, hey, I'm number one on product hunt, or hey, did you see that thing on product hunt like yesterday? If we had entirely personalized feeds, we couldn't have those conversations and it wouldn't have the same water cooler effect that it has today.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So Product Hunt is going well, and you actually got accepted. You applied and got accepted into YC.
Yeah, that's right.
How was that? Was that the moment when you thought like, okay, this is going to be big?
We were maybe 4 or 5 months into past the email list when it first started. And Y Combinator, the current batch, a lot of them were using Product Hunt themselves and they were launching. What's funny is I just spoke with Gary Tan, who used to be at YC a few days ago, and I was just reflecting on this. And one of the founders of Algolia, who was in YC at the time, he DM'd me on Twitter and said, hey, Ryan, are you, you know, what are you doing with Product Hunt? Are you thinking about doing Y Combinator? Gary Tan would love to meet you. So I met with Gary at the Grove here in San Francisco and chatted with him. And this was right at the crossroads where it was, you know, what am I going to do with this thing? What's the long-term plan? Do we build this into a business? If we do, do we raise capital, raise VC and go that route? Or do we find a different path?
And at this point, you were still at Playhaven?
This point, I was not at Playhaven anymore.
Okay, so you left at this point. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I left and I worked at Playhaven part-time for a while, which allowed me to pay my rent, basically. but yeah, I had left at that point, but I was still figuring out. And we were actually making, I think it was around $4,000 a month, which paid like our Heroku bill and things like that. So
yeah. So even in its side project phase, you'd left Playhaven. And at that point, did you leave specifically to pursue Product Hunt, or did you leave and thought maybe Product Hunt will be the thing? Who knows?
It was more the latter. I was thinking, you know, maybe this will be it, but I really want to be thoughtful in, especially when it comes to raising capital. And this was my conversation with Gary. The primary reason why I wanted to meet him was, one, get his feedback and advice, because he's before that and started companies. Because it's a one-way door. You can't really give money back. You can't. I mean, you can, but it's really really messy and would not advise it. And so I wanted to be assured that this was the right thing to pursue long-term. Mm-hmm. And so I talked to Gary and there were some words that stuck out for me. He said, very infrequently do people catch lightning in a bottle, like Product Hunt was at the time, especially. And what he meant by that was we dabble and we build and we try to build a product that people use and love. And most of it's not going to work out. And in the moments where it does start to work and show signs of being something really meaningful, you got to really double down on that and really recognize that. And so after that conversation, I met with Kat, I met with Kevin Hale, met with Alexis Ohanian, and then decided to apply to Y Combinator and ended up getting in the summer 2014.
Wow. So you had some pretty big conversations with some pretty big people before you even decided.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, that's awesome. They were I mean, part of it was they were trying to recruit Product Hunt is the reality. they wanted Product Hunt to be in. And so speaking with them, but I still went through the whole process, did the video interview, did the in-person interview, did the whole application.
So you were part of YC in 2014. Now it is many years later. You have been acquired by AngelList over the past, 4 or 5 years. What has been the biggest product changes of Product Hunt?
Yeah, we built a lot of things. Some things have worked. A lot of them haven't, which is expected, I think, with anything. I think a lot of what we're noticing and a lot of what we're shifting towards over the past, particularly the past year or so, is Product Hunt is known and is really kind of a launch pad for new companies, new products. It's a place to discover what's new and what's coming up. And that's kind of what we're known for. But what we've noticed is there's a lot of desire within sort of the maker and technology community of people wanting to connect together and help each other and get feedback. And I'm reflecting back on when Product Hunt first started, there was really no place for me to, one, even connect with other people that were outside my network to like get help, whether it's with design or engineering.
That's true. And, yeah.
And two, there was no, I fortunately had a small audience through blogging that, as I mentioned earlier, but most people don't have enough people. They have just their friends, and their friends might be fine beta testers, but you know, at the end of the day, your friends are probably going to be overly nice and say how awesome your product is, and and perhaps they're not even the right users either. So reflecting on that, what we really are exploring more of and building on is how do we make Product Hunt more of a social network, in the sense that this is a place for makers and people building technology, and whether it's a side project or a new startup, a place to get help, share their goals, have social accountability, get feedback, get beta users, and really connect with other like-minded people across the world that are also really into technology.
Yeah. And so when we think about a social network, what does that actually translate to? Is that a discussion forum? Is it a live chat? Like, how, what are the features or actual products that come from that, at least for Product Hunt?
There's a number of things. There's some very, I would say, relatively minor or tactical things. And this goes back to what I said earlier about observing user behavior. Mm-hmm. What we noticed is oftentimes people in the Product Hunt comments, when there's a product being launched, there'll be a conversation between maybe the maker and some other person, and they'll basically take the conversation offline, whether it's, hey, I'll help you with this. Oh, email me here. Or, hey, I have experience building in this space. DM me on Twitter, and I'll love to give you advice or feedback. And so we notice this behavior happening. And obviously, that's kind of inefficient. And, you know, people generally don't want to share their email on a public forum like that either. So we introduced private messaging, where you can just simply message another user on Product Hunt, which, you know, not the most innovative, crazy idea, but it's very simply based on clearly there's a need for this. Clearly there's a desire to communicate privately. Yeah. And we also built some like very native, authentic ways of that. So if you see a comment on Product Hunt, you can actually click the message button, which will basically include a snippet of that comment. So there's context around why this person is messaging you. So there's things like that we kind of built in to allow for more of that, those connections. And then a lot of what we're building, actually the thing I'm super excited about that I haven't talked about yet is we've kind of been building this platform for people to share their goals, whether it's, you know, get 100 beta users, share, redesign my website. And what we're seeing is people are organically kind of reaching out and saying, hey, I'm happy to, you know, read a draft of your blog post before it goes up, or I would love to beta test your product. So we're doubling down on that with some really interesting, you know, I don't even know if this is the right messaging, but kind of like virtual co-working is what we want to build. And ways to create social accountability, help people share what they're working on, and ultimately help people help each other.
Oh, I love that. That's wonderful. So now you are still running Product Hunt, but you're also an investor with the Weekend Fund, which I understand is a $3 million fund for early stage startups. So between doing Product Hunt, selling that, being a product guy for many, many years, what do you look for in other products and in people who are hoping to turn their products into businesses?
Yeah, so I've learned a lot in investing over the past almost year and a half now, and I'm focusing in very early stage. So everything from, I spoke with a founder a couple of days ago, and someone I've known for a while, so I have a lot of trust and know their background, but they just started 2 weeks ago. They have no product. And I committed to invest. And so sometimes there's very early stage companies like that. In other cases, they have a product out there and there's some traction, but generally it's pretty early. And when it's early, you either don't have data or you have such limited data that's really hard to evaluate by, because, you know, retention numbers, you just don't have enough. That's really what matters, like retention and like usage. And it's always going to be artificial in the beginning. Like, you'll never really know how retentive a product is in the very first 3-6 months sometimes. And so a lot of what I look for is combination of, I mean, there's certain things that every investor says, like team and market and all of that. And that's true. But what I also try to look for is like my girlfriend's also an investor, and she has a saying of like clarity of vision. And I like that saying, because when you speak with the founder and there's very clear vision of what they're building, it's very telling. And actually the way that they communicate, I think communication is so important as a CEO or a founder, is that it really informs how well they're going to be able to fundraise, recruit, sell, all of these things. And if they're able to have a strong perspective, that means a lot, and a perspective of the future. And so there's an example of one company that hasn't launched yet that I committed to invest before they had a product. In fact, they didn't even have a full like pitch deck ready because he had such a strong vision of what he's building for. And it was one of those conversations where I learned some things coming out of it. Mm-hmm. Whereas in cases where I don't necessarily learn something, it's not because I think I know everything by any means, but when you can kind of predict the answers that they're going to say or the direction that they're going to the head, then you're like, well, if they're thinking about this 24/7 and I have thought about those same ideas,
that's a good point. Yeah.
Something's off. So those are some different lenses or criteria I kind of look for when I'm speaking to founders.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what advice do you have for folks listening who are hoping to build an awesome product one day or maybe get into product management themselves?
Honestly, I think my biggest piece of advice is just build, just tinker and experiment. Mm. Like think about what would you want to build or what ideas do you have? And I think building is a great way to, of course, learn whether it's learning how to be a better coder or different frameworks, how to design. It's kind of like, I see it very similar to other forms of art, you know, being a musician. You know, musicians, if you're a drummer, you practice all the time. Mm-hmm. And I feel building and just creating things is kind of like practice for being a founder or being a product manager or engineer or whatnot.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, I feel like, pressure. People put pressure on themselves to build a startup and then name themselves founder and assume that they're going to go raise money. But I think it's fine just to build stuff too. Like build stuff because you think it's cool and interesting, and that will go a long way. And if you want to get into product management, you know, I mentioned earlier, it's really hard to get a job if you don't have product management experience. The best thing next to that though is having side projects and basically being your own PM. Like you can have product management experience by building stuff on your own and showing in your resume or when you're speaking with recruiters saying, hey, I built XYZ and here's my thought process and how I went about it.
Yeah, make your own Trello board, write those user stories. You can do a lot of the same stuff, just do it for yourself.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Ryan, for spending so much time with us and telling us the story of Product Hunt and product management. You want to say goodbye?
Thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
And that's the end of the episode. Let me know what you think. Tweet me at CodeNewbies or send me an email, hello@codenewbie.org. For more info on the podcast, check out www.codenewbie.org/podcast. And join us for our weekly Twitter chats. We've got our Wednesday chats, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and our weekly coding check-in every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks for listening. See you next week.